if things that were going on in this community were happening on 56th Street, 56 and Kessler, people would not be silent about it. People would be enraged. Like, it doesn't even have to be in Carmel. It could just be a little further north, and people would be very upset about what was going on.
Welcome back to the IBJ Podcast. I'm Mason King. Now, that voice you just heard belongs to Trenisha English, who was a club director at the Wheeler Dow Boys and Girls Club on East 30th Street in the Martindale-Brightwood neighborhood. Now, here's a number that's going to be important to today's discussion. 46218. That's the zip code that includes Martindale-Brightwood. And since the year 2000, the median household income in that zip code has decreased 13%. And since 2011, the median assessed property value has decreased 14%. While, of course, in other areas of the city, property values have exploded. And we're seeing this trend across the city. Since 2000, median household incomes have actually dropped in a third of Indianapolis zip codes, 12 of the 36. And in that same period, median household incomes increased by at least 10% in 16 zip codes. So, as you probably have guessed, the topic of today's podcast is the growing income disparity, the gap between the affluent and the poor across the city of Indianapolis. This has reached a crisis level for some of our poorest residents, but it's a serious problem for everybody. And here to tell us why is IBJ reporter Haley Colombo. Hey, Haley.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure. Now, listeners might already have seen the first two installments of Haley's series, One City, Worlds Apart, in the IBJ. But more significantly, IBJ has decided to expand its coverage of income inequality and poverty to the level of a regular beat, which, of course, is probably pretty unusual for a business publication. So how did this come about? I really wasn't privy to this, unfortunately. Why did we decide we wanted to devote so much energy to writing about something that it really isn't in this field, the sphere of experience for most of our readers?
Absolutely. Just to be sort of blunt about it, I think some of us, me included, got sort of tired about, you know, on one day writing about the latest artisanal donut shop opening and the growing tech community and just all these really cool things going on in our city. But then the next day I would get a press release about, you know, the homeless population is in crisis, or they're shutting down a homeless camp, or the level of poverty is rising, or the people who are going hungry, that number is rising too. There was just some discussion here about, like, it's almost like we have two cities. We almost have these just two, and that's sort of why we called it One City, Worlds Apart, because it's like you could be a couple streets away from somewhere and the reality there could just be completely different from yours. And it's an issue for the future prosperity of our city, and it's an issue that so many of our residents are dealing with. The other thing is, this being a business publication, a lot of times we're writing about and talking to people who are high up in the business world. They're important, they're powerful, that sort of thing. And I think sort of what I've realized through this is those people are just as much a part of the business community and the economy as people who are poor and who have no power and who are working in minimum wage jobs. We're all part of the same economy, but the economy isn't working for some people and it is working for other people. And I feel like it's important to try to figure out why.
Yeah. What are the ramifications, though, for the business community? I mean, can you give us a business case for why people should care?
Yeah, absolutely. I think people in the business world should care because there's so much talk right now about a skills gap or businesses that are having trouble finding workers, finding enough workers to take some jobs that they have. So they're having sort of a labor shortage problem with our overall low unemployment rate, and we'll get to that later. It's not as rosy as it seems in some areas of the city, but, you know, they're having trouble filling jobs with workers, and there are workers here who are underemployed, who are in poverty. So it's almost like this question of how are these two things happening at the same time?
Is there then also a cost, too, of letting one population descend too far?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I was covering the state legislature before, and in the, you know, budget process every 2 years, you know, we're paying for DCS, we're paying for children from low-income families, we're paying for a lot of this later. You could actually make a pretty good conservative business decision that trying to stop some of this before it reaches the levels of having to require big public investment is actually a sort of a conservative thing to do.
That's a great point. I didn't think about that, but there's a great example this week of Governor Holcomb saying, well, we got to take $25 million out of the budget surplus so we can help fix DCS, the Department of Child Services.
Right, exactly. And, you know, if some of those problems had been solved upstream, maybe we wouldn't have had to do that.
Is there also a moral case for this? Can we go that far?
Oh, absolutely. You know, being a good citizen of our city means caring about people who aren't doing as well. Mm-hmm. And I know that there's a lot of people out there who feel the same way. Researcher Tess Weathers from IU said this really well.
If you're born in certain communities of this city right now with a sad level of accuracy, I think we could probably predict your life is going to be a good bit shorter than if you're born somewhere else. And that goes against a basic sense of fairness. And I think what we feel as like our obligation as members of society to sort of just support other people's right to have a fair chance at things. And we're not saying equal chance because there's no way of guaranteeing equal chances, right? Certain people in society are going to have more advantages than others, and that's probably to some extent inevitable, but we can surely narrow that gap.
It's difficult. There is a 10-year gap in life expectancy between my zip code, 46220, that's the one I live in, to 46218, a community now that I've spent a good bit of time in, and that bothers me.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. And to what Trenisha said, specifically about 56th Street, and that if what was happening in 46218 was happening on 56th Street, there would be an uproar. It's not happening on 56th Street, but it is pretty damn close.
Yeah, absolutely. It's Martindale Brightwood is not, I mean, I drive through it every day to get to work. I mean, it's absolutely, I mean, it's really close to Meridian Kessler, which is one of the, you know, most sort of exclusive places to live in the city. I mean, it's, yeah, it's close.
Yeah. So I grew up in 46220. I grew up at 57th and Broadway.
Okay.
Which at the time, you know, not like the high ticket Meridian Kessler. I mean, maybe working class Meridian Kessler, if that's possible. This was back in the 80s, of course. Even back then, I mean, there was obviously some pronounced stratification in that area of incomes. I mean, I knew that if I went, you know, 8 blocks southeast, I was going to be in a different neighborhood. And depending on the time of day, I might be in danger. But what is really fascinating that I think you brought home pretty well in that first series was that if I go on the Monon Trail right now on 52nd Street and I'm still in 46220,
mm-hmm.
I pedal down to 38th Street on the Monon Trail. Now I'm in 46218. This is a different world. I mean, the expectations that you would have for my income, my employment level, for my property values, and as you said, even, you know, my life expectancy are totally different.
Absolutely. I mean, there are some zip codes in Indianapolis that have a similar life expectancy to that of Iraq.
Good Lord.
Yeah. Very shocking.
What is that for 6218? Is it like 60?
The life 70? Expectancy there is about 70, as opposed to Martin, or as opposed to Meridian Kessler or 46220, it's about 80. So it's like 10 years, yeah.
So just looking at that, why?
So the reasons why someone's life expectancy may be shorter in a different zip code is sort of a combination of factors. It's not like just that years get shaved off at the end. It's, you know, whether there's a higher infant mortality rate in that area or whether it's a higher level of teenage deaths due to gun violence, it's, or a higher level of heart disease or some other, you know, health situation because of a lack of healthcare. Healthcare is expensive. There's a lot of reasons.
So you spend a lot of time at 46218. This might be a little bit too general, but I mean, what are your impressions? I mean, what are the things that have really stuck out as you spent time there?
What's really interesting is I hadn't spent a lot of, I'd spent a lot of like driving through time, but not a lot of like stopping and talking and meeting people time. And I think sort of like what Trinitia said, like people are the same everywhere. People want the same things everywhere. So it's, I don't necessarily find it to be like that different of a place from Meridian Kessler in terms of like, you know, the people I've met and how much they care about their neighborhood. Seems like I haven't met a group of people who care more about their neighborhood than the people I've talked with, but the results seem to be different. You know, there's just a different level of investment in neighborhoods like Martindale, Brightwood, and it's not through lack of wanting it to be better or the amount of effort that individual people want to put in. That seems to be, you know, neighborhood engagement there seems to be pretty high. And there's actually a lot of efforts underway right now to try to improve things for their citizens.
But what has happened, if you had to boil it down to two or three main things, why is that on a downward trajectory?
So I think a couple things. I think that the building the interstate sort of cut that neighborhood in half, and that was a problem. I think that
this is the 6570.
Yes.
Interstate, which was it late 60s, early 70s?
Yes.
They kind of carved up
that sort of
northern portion of it.
Yeah, like there's sidewalks. Some of the residents there took me on like a little sort of bus tour of the neighborhood, and there's sidewalks that just stop, and the interstate's right above it. So it's like you literally like cut the, you know what I mean? It's like that was a sidewalk that led somewhere, and now it doesn't go anywhere. So that's sort of odd. And then obviously that just like sort of cuts down a community. I think, you know, drugs and violence have been, you know, struggles for the neighborhood. I think, you know, sort of the criminal justice system and systemic racism within that system has led to over criminalization or jailing of Black men who would be breadwinners in that neighborhood. I think there's a lot of factors. I think industry left. Railroads used to be there, and sort of there used to be a big sort of business district there and lots of vibrancy. And, you know, just with white flight, those things, you know, cause things to move out of town. So it's sort of like a downward trajectory, not necessarily one thing, but a combination of factors.
Yeah. And speaking about the neighborhood, but also, you know, to an extent, other areas of the city that are experiencing elevated poverty. What's happening with the jobs? I mean, it's, you know, we have allegedly, I shouldn't say allegedly, it's probably perfectly well measured, very low unemployment. Why are these people working?
What's really interesting is I heard it phrased pretty well by Drew Classic, who's a, you know, researcher here in town at IU, and he was sort of describing our economy as a barbell economy, which is we have a lot of, so if you imagine a barbell and you imagine sort of the two sort of weighted ends of it, as on one hand you have sort of the lower class service sector jobs, and on the other weighted end of it you have the higher class innovation jobs, you know, tech company jobs, that sort of thing. In the middle, the little bar in the middle, it's thinned out. It's used to be a log and now it's a barbell. Like there used to be a lot of middle income, middle skill jobs that you didn't need a ton of, you didn't need a high degree to have a middle income, and mostly due to automation, but due, yes, to some outsourcing, a lot of those, you know, middle income jobs have gone away. We've even seen, you know, especially since 2008, we saw a lot of that. And even just in the last couple years, you know, with Rexnerd and Carrier, I mean, those are real people who work there. I mean, they had good jobs there. And now, like, what's replacing it? I mean, they could find jobs in the service sector, but those jobs don't pay very well.
So here's my devil's advocate question. We hear all the time, I mean, at the different events that we go to, Indianapolis employers have job openings. They want to hire people. They can't because they don't have the right skills. So why don't people just go out and get the necessary skills with the training that they need?
What's really interesting about that is that it's really hard work to be poor. One family I talked to who is actually living in a homeless shelter right now near like 16th street, just, you know, smack dab in the heart of the city. Both parents of that family are regularly working. The dad has lost his job right now, but he's trying to find another one. But like the mom works full time and, you know, takes the bus back and forth to her job downtown where she's a waitress. Their car was towed because they couldn't afford to get it repaired. So it was like, you know, not working, and then it got towed. And, you know, the mom has a degree in, like, I think a CNA sort of medical assistant type degree, but she needs, you know, refresher courses. Even if she had money to go back and get more training, then who pays for their childcare when they're, you know, there? Who pays for the missing income? It's like almost this trap. A lot of people find themselves stuck in these scenarios. Something so small that would not derail either one of us can derail someone who's lower income. Like, a car breaks down, $500. That can derail a person's entire financial situation.
Yeah, it sounds like quicksand. You know, instead of, you know, the analogy of, you know, we'll just jump out of the pool, it's like trying to jump out of quicksand when you're already neck deep. We talk a lot about how Indianapolis, or at least, you know, particular parts of Indianapolis are improving because they're getting big private and public investment. Obviously, there's been a lot happening downtown for the last, for the last 45 years, but it's sort of continuous. You know, there's several emerging hot neighborhoods downtown-ish. A broader pool in some ways is a completely different place than it was 20 years ago. So there's a lot of investment. Do people in these communities like 46218, do they see themselves benefiting from this somehow?
I think it's sort of complicated because, as some people say, you know, downtown is everyone's neighborhood, right? So, you know, if people have the resources to go spend in downtown and take advantage of some of the, you know, development and whatnot, then possibly they feel like they're benefiting from it. But I would say largely they don't. Largely they feel isolated, especially if they don't have a car, they don't have access to transportation. They're isolated from a lot of the economic progress that's happened in some of the areas. I think Larae Troutman from the Brightwood Community Center put this pretty well, just sort of the complex, you know, feeling she has about development downtown versus stagnation in her own neighborhood.
I love downtown, and I love, you know, the areas around downtown and how they've made it so beautiful. But again, when I ride through the east side, I just, you know, shake my head at, like, why aren't we putting money into these communities? Mm-hmm. You know, they're the ones that come out and keep your communities thriving, mm-hmm. because we have nothing here, so mm-hmm. we have to go and spend our money elsewhere. But yeah, I mean, I love my city, and I think, you know, yeah. I think it should be beautiful, but I think it should be beautiful from top to bottom.
Okay, so I'll hit you with the argument that we hear a lot. For investing public dollars or encouraging private investment, using public dollars to leverage private investment in parts of the cities that are already doing well. The argument usually goes, okay, we need to attract people with good incomes into Indianapolis proper so we can tax that income, we can tax their fancy real estate, and then we can use that money to help everybody. What's wrong with that approach?
I don't think people are necessarily wanting to completely stop that approach. I don't think people don't get that. If you invest somewhere, it could pay dividends somewhere else. I feel uncomfortable making sort of a judgment about the approach of the city. I just definitely, like, you can see the disinvestment in other areas.
Mm-hmm. Well, is nothing being done to help these communities and people falling into poverty? Or are there some initiatives outside of what we consider the social safety net and the help of our not-for-profits?
I think the people who work in this area would say that, yes, there's some help from philanthropy and that sort of thing, but it's a, sort of a patchwork type situation. Something I've had to rethink and toss around is this idea that a lot of when we drive through a neighborhood and we say that we're, like, improving that neighborhood or trying to make that better, like, what we really mean is we're improving how it looks or improving how houses look and how nice they are and what businesses look like and that sort of thing. But what do we do in terms of helping people and sort of enriching people and helping them to share in prosperity of the city. And I think that people in some neighborhoods want to feel invested in.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to my grumpy old man for a second. I think that there's a feeling in the hearts of some that anybody can dig themselves out of poverty. It just takes a good work ethic and some good old Midwestern grit, and you can dig yourself out of poverty.
It's really interesting when you put yourself in someone's shoes, like some of the hurdles that the people I've met have had to go through. And I think, would I be well equipped to also do the same thing? A lot of how you do in the world has, you know, a lot to do with your container. You know, some of the benefits that we have are primarily unearned benefits, unearned advantages. And I think that there's some pushback on that. There's a lot of, you know, pushback on the idea of privilege and defining what that means. But I don't know, I think it's pretty apparent that, like, I came from a very privileged background, and thus I have some advantages that other people don't have.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you brought up the concept of, like, your container, like the environment you grew up in. I know you spoke with Rhiannon Edwards, who's executive director of PACE. And I'm sorry, the acronym escapes me for a second. I know what they do, but what is that?
They are focused on community reentry. So they help people who are coming out of the criminal justice center get jobs, get the social services they need, get mental health if they need that, and just sort of reintegrate into society.
Okay, let's hear what you had to say about this container idea.
A lot of how you function, a lot of how you feel, a lot of what you give back or put out to people has to do with your container and your environment. And if I'm in an environment where we're struggling financially, people are selling drugs, crime is happening, whatever's happening, I feel beat down enough. Mm-hmm. How am I going to build myself up in this environment to do better? And then how frustrated am I going to be when I drive two streets over and I see how great it is over here and then I see where I live? And I think it's great that as a city we, you know, we're building up certain areas, and I'm all for that. Mm-hmm. But I think that we also need to do some building up in these other neighborhoods.
Haley, thanks so much for the hard work. This is a great thing, and I'm proud that we're doing it.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
My thanks again to Haley Colombo for filling us in on IBJ's expanded coverage of income inequality and poverty. Now, there are a couple of stories related to our conversation in this week's edition of IBJ. Haley reports that an initiative aimed specifically at the talent gap in Indiana, this dearth of workers qualified for open jobs, is ramping up its operations with $9 million recently raised. The name of the group is Ascend, like up, Ascend, Indiana. And on the subject of neglected neighborhoods that have started to revive, Scott Olson outlines the surge of development in the Stadium Village area south of downtown. And it's an example of residents and businesses coming together to develop a mutually beneficial plan. You can find these stories in our print edition and at ibj.com. I'm Mason King. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week.